RTE Pulse.
The Cosmo with Scott the Butler. Radio for Ireland's gay and lesbian community.
You're listening to The Cosmo with myself, Scott Butler, here on RTE Pulse. Now, whatever bit what's been taking place here in Ireland to do with LGBT rights, the Irish diaspora, or at least Irish festivals abroad, are also coming under the spotlight in terms of their stance on LGBT people. The mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, has said that he will not take part in this year's St. Patrick's Day parade because of the parade's exclusion of LGBT people. The group, and numerous groups actually in New York that of Irish descent or of Irish Americans, have praised him and are also expecting, or hoping at least, that many Irish politicians will do the same. Well, to join me on the phone to explain this a bit more and to give us a bit of context, I have Maya Gelman from the group Irish Queers, an Irish American LGBT group based in New York. Maya, you're very welcome along.
Thanks.
So give us a bit of background onto this, because I guess the news didn't break in Ireland until the mayor, and the recently elected mayor, we should point out, Bill de Blasio, announced that he wasn't going to be taking part. But this isn't something that has just come out of the blue, I guess.
It hasn't come out of the blue at all. This is a 23-year-old struggle, which has been going on in New York City and also has made its way to Ireland in various years. The very, very short version of the history is that in 1991, the Irish Lesbian and Gay Organization, which was a group mostly of immigrants from Ireland, applied to march in the St. Patrick's Day Parade as a way of being visible and kind of trying to break down the closet walls, as it were. And they were denied the right to march in a variety of ways, through duplicity and waiting lists and all sorts of things. That very first year, they marched as invited guests, and the homophobia that they experienced was just awful. And in fact, Mayor Dinkins, the mayor of the city at the time, who was also the city's first black mayor, marched with them in solidarity, and they got beer cans thrown at them, and, you know, it was just awful. And they swore that they would fight to march and never march again, except in their full capacity as members of the community. That went on for, that struggle to march went on for a long time, and in the process of it, the parade organizers went to court to define the parade not as an Irish procession but rather as a private Catholic procession with the right to exclude.
Wow.
And they did that because the city's human rights commissioners told them that if in a public event that they had to follow human rights law, and human rights law says you can't discriminate against people because they're queer.
Right, of course.
So that's gone on for a very long time, and the police and the firefighters from New York City and also from lots of other places make up a huge portion of the march. I mean, it's not really an Irish parade at all anymore, if it ever was. It's not now. There's oceans of police and firefighters.
That's really, really fascinating, because I guess to a lot of, you know, to the regular Irish person, when they see the likes of the St. Paddy's Day parades in, you know, the likes of New York or Boston or anywhere else in the US, they do think that it's just, you know, the Irish diaspora. But when you put it in that kind of context, that's almost frightening, I think, that, you know, it's so different in some ways to, you know, the actual Irish American community, and especially the Irish LGBT community that's based in New York. Considering that context or that historical background, which in some ways is shocking even to me, what was your reaction to Bill de Blasio's announcement in that case?
It's great that he's not going to march in the parade. No progressive or actually even centrist politician has marched in the parade for years because of the exclusion, because really the defining characteristic of the parade is that it's a homophobic march with an explicit anti-gay message. So people stay away from it, and it's sort of par for the course, but also really good that he's staying away from it. For the previous 8 years, we had a mayor who marched in it. He also tried to have it both ways. He also marched in an inclusive St. Patrick's Day parade and tried to pretend he was friends to all sides. So it's good to have a mayor who's not going to do that. The real issue for us, though, there are two issues. One is that the police and the firefighters still march in the parade, and also they have a larger and longer history of discrimination against queers, against people of color, against low-income people. They're not known for respecting the city's human rights law particularly, and so the fact that they march in this, what we understand now to be like the biggest display of anti-queer bigotry in the country, they march in it every year, and they're totally fixated on it, and the idea that they would be asked not to march in their uniforms is horrifying to them. Well, that's part of a larger problem that we're hoping that the mayor will help us address. It's a violation of human rights law for them to be in the parade. And so we've asked the mayor to direct them not to march in the parade. Now, he hasn't done that, but I would say that conversation is not over. But I want to say one more thing, which is that in 1991 and 92, when Algo was marching, and since then when they were protesting on the sidelines, you know, the attitude of the community has changed enormously. It was really horrible the first year and homophobic, and now just, you know, sort of along the stride of Ireland, that kind of homophobia is not the norm anymore. It's really just in the parade.
That's really, really fascinating. Again, it just actually goes to show the difference in perception, I think. Now, I was aware personally of a, as you called it, the inclusive march, which I think takes place in Queens, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Okay, and obviously that came out of the fact that you know, Irish LGBT people have been excluded from the, if you want to call it, the normal or the better known parade. Does that still take place?
It does still take place, and I don't want to speak for the organizers, but I think the point of it is partly that the Fifth Avenue parade, not only is it discriminatory, but it's horrible. Yeah. You know, it's basically like a bunch of army officers and police and firefighters marching in their ranks down the avenue, you know, behaving in some cases terribly and in other cases, you know, more mildly. And then interspersed between them are a few Catholic school bands and the occasional visiting dance troupe from, you know, Basque country. I mean, it's a very strange effect.
Strange mixture.
And it's not really an Irish parade at all.
Yeah.
And the parade in Queens is also, it's very multicultural, but it's intended to be a St. Patrick's Day parade that reflects the spirit of parades more like they are in Ireland, where they're actually fun.
Oh, okay. It's an interesting way of putting it, all right. Now, obviously, you know, Bill de Blasio has made this statement, and it's caused ripples, and it, you know, obviously it's caused news headlines as well throughout the LGBT media and definitely mainstream media as well. What about, from your perception, you know, as part of the larger Irish-American or Irish LGBT community in New York, what are you hoping to see from Ireland?
Well, it's been really great over the years to get support from Irish queer groups in Ireland, north and south. There have been letters of support, and there have been requests to Irish elected officials not to march, and letters of solidarity. And it's really exciting to see it happening again and to be taken up by government officials in a way that it seems like it hadn't necessarily been taken up in the past.
Yeah.
So to see that some government officials are talking about boycotting is terrific and exciting. And to see the request from some Irish queer groups for all officials to stay out, including the guards and other representatives who would sort of parallel the police and the fire department, it's really helpful. I mean, part of the pushback here is that the parade organizers have created this monopoly on who's allowed to say that they're Irish, and it's just them. It's just like the old white guys, you know, who just came from Mass, and that's just not the case. So to have excitement and interest from Ireland saying that's really not who we are is just incredibly helpful, and it takes away their power to define Irishness as some sort of 1950s, you know, suburban backwater.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Right. Well, look, listen, it's something that I think we would be able to talk about for so long. And, you know, even for me personally, what you've actually shown to me tonight is that there's so much about the Irish LGBT movement and community in New York that I think a lot of us back here in Ireland don't really know about. So there's no doubt in my mind that you're going to be back onto this show sometime soon, hopefully. In the meantime, Amaya Gelman of Irish Queers, thank you so much for coming onto the show tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thanks to everyone who's being supportive from Ireland. It matters a lot. We really appreciate it.
RTE Pulse. The Cosmo with Scott the Butler. Radio for Ireland's gay and lesbian community.
Well, we've heard the story in New York. Let's go back to Dublin. And on the phone with me at the moment, Adam Long is from the National LGBT Federation, formerly known as the NLGF. They are also supporting what is taking place in New York as well, and also echoing similar opinions to that of Amaya. Adam, you're very welcome along to the show.
Thank you very much, Scott. Good evening. And before I start, I believe birthday congratulations are in order.
Oh, thank you very, very much. You obviously saw the Facebook update, so thank you.
I did indeed. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Listen, Adam, this is a very interesting situation. And again, you know, whatever about what's been taking place here in Ireland, it's in a very strange way. This is putting Ireland's LGBT situation and the LGBT status of even the Irish in America under the spotlight. It's a strange situation, it must be said, that, you know, LGBT people can't march in New York and yet they can in Ireland, which is a very strange thing. But obviously you guys are supporting Bill de Blasio's announcement.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you raise an important point there when you talk about the difference between the approach taken in the New York parade and the inclusive parades that are in Ireland. This isn't an issue in Ireland. It's never been an issue. All the parades that happen in Ireland, and in fact, parades even internationally outside of New York, there's no discriminatory approach. There's no prejudice, essentially. So, yes, we are very much supporting the position that the mayor, Mayor de Blasio, has taken. And indeed, the Minister for Social Protection, Joan Burton, has also now made clear that she will refuse an invitation based on the policy of effectively excluding a whole segment of society. And it has to be said, a very important part of the broader Irish-American community.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the news about Joan Burton is still recent enough. She said that she will be in New York during that time for different matters, but that she won't be paying attention, or she won't be taking part in the parade. Isn't that right?
That's right. And she did say that she participated in 2011, and that experience, if anything, has firmed up her view that the way the organisers, the policy of the organisers, isn't actually a very, I suppose, a very inclusive reflection of what it means to be Irish, what it means to be part of the global Irish family. And she made clear that unless that policy changed, unless the anti-gay policy of the parade changed, then she wouldn't accept an invitation. And what we, and I know other groups as well, other LGBT groups, have been calling for is for all Irish officials to take a principled stand, to follow Mayor de Blasio and now to follow Minister Joan Burton, and to make clear that being Irish means that it's a celebration of diversity, it's a celebration of inclusion, and no part of that society should be excluded. And I think also, Scott, it's very important because I've seen a little bit of what I would call misinformed commentary around the exact nature of the policy as regards LGBT people. It's been wrongly claimed that LGBT people are allowed to march in the parade as long as they don't march under any kind of political signage or any kind of political banner, yeah, and that the same standard applies to LGBT groups as anyone else. That's not correct. And it's very clear that we established that as a matter of fact. Any symbol, political or otherwise, even a small maybe rainbow lapel, anything that identifies somebody as being openly LGBT, they're excluded from this parade. And that doesn't apply to the many other community groups that are allowed to participate and are allowed to, you know, to take part under their individual banners and to depict who they are. So there is a very clear double standard being applied here. And it does also, I think, raise questions about who we want to be organising such a big event and a big celebration of Irishness. Because the particular organisation, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, they do have very explicit anti-LGBT views and have made them known. And I think even beyond the LGBT aspect, I think it's very concerning, it's very disturbing that a group that is so, what I would say, is so out of sync with modern Ireland and modern Irish values, that they are the ones who would be promoting this big event. And I would, what we would be urging is that the alternative inclusive parade, and I know high-profile figures like Hillary Clinton and others have participated in that, and that takes place, it also takes place in New York, and which is open to everyone and doesn't exclude any group. I think that's the parade that should be supported and promoted by the Irish government.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, it remains to be seen, I guess, what will happen from this side of the water. But it is very admirable, and it's in some ways very brave as well, the decision that Mayor Bill de Blasio has made and with his announcement recently. But in the meantime, we're going to have to leave it there. Adam Long from the National LGBT Foundation, thank you very, very much for coming on to the show.
Thank you, Scott.
RTE Pulse.
The Cosmo with Scott the Butler. Radio for Ireland's gay and lesbian community.
Well, let me know what you thought of the opinions from both New York and from Dublin. You can get in touch with us, thecosmo@rte.ie, or if you're on Twitter, it's at Scott the Butler or at RTE Cosmo. Now, I have to say hello to Jer and also to Marion, who were tweeting in from Dublin and also saying happy birthday to me. Adam Long let that slip earlier on in the show, so thank you very, very much. And also want to play Nadia Ali, Rapture. This is the Avicii New Generation remix. This is a brand new song that I've heard, and I have to admit, I absolutely love it. So see what you think yourself. You are listening to The Cosmo on RTE Pulse.
RTE Pulse.
The Cosmo with Scott the Butler. Radio for Ireland's gay and lesbian community.
You're listening to The Cosmo with myself, Scott Butler, here on RTE Pulse. Now, it is that time of the month here on the show where we invite our resident sexual health expert, Dr. Shay Keating, into the studio to give us a bit of a chat about all things health-related and things we should be keeping an eye out for. Shay, you're very welcome along.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for having me.
I was saying before we went on air was that, you know, I'm noticing the likes of articles and sometimes ads for what's being called rapid HIV testing, right?
Yeah.
Now, from what I know, usually HIV testing can take up to 2 weeks in the normal sense of it, but obviously things have changed dramatically over the last while.
They have. Maybe, Scott, before I actually talk about the rapid HIV test, I'll give you a bit of a background
on
how we got to the stage. I mean, in 1984, HIV was first identified, and shortly after that, we had what was called an antibody test developed so we could actually measure in the blood the antibodies to the HIV virus so we could tell when people had been exposed or were actually HIV positive.
Okay.
So the next thing then, a few years later, we got something called the antigen test. Now, for those who don't know, the difference between an antibody and an antigen is the antigen is a foreign particle, which is, say, a part of the virus.
Okay.
The antibody is what your body makes to try and fight it off,
right,
or try to kill it off.
Okay.
So first we had the antibody test. Then a few years later, we had the antigen test. And then there is a newer test now called the NAT test, which actually measures the genetic material of the virus. And that all sounds very sciencey, but it actually can be quite important, because in medicine, or particularly in HIV medicine, we have what's called the window period when we're testing patients. So if you can imagine, you are exposed to HIV today.
Right.
But obviously, if we do test on you today, it's going to be negative. And I'll tell you the reasons. Number one, because the body wouldn't have made antibodies in sufficient numbers that we could actually pick up in the test. That's number one. So that time from zero to when we can actually, when the test is actually measurable, we can pick up the antibodies. It's called the window period.
Okay.
So the window period for, we say, an antibody test is usually around a month, but just to be sure we've picked up everybody, we'd always recommend we test patients 3 months later after the exposure.
Okay, so fully make sure that.
Fully make sure. Yeah. So 99.9% of patients who are HIV positive will be picked up on an antibody test 3 months after they've been exposed.
Wow. Okay.
So the antigen tests then are more sensitive. What they do is they actually pick up the virus, the viral particle, much earlier. So if you do a test, after about 2 to 3 weeks, the antigen test will be positive and you can tell much sooner.
Wow.
And the newer tests I mentioned, the genetic material tests, they're actually for bringing it sooner back to a week, maybe 2 weeks. So when you do the test, you can pick up the infection much faster.
That's absolutely fascinating.
So over the last 30 years, as I said, things have changed hugely. So now we don't have to wait for 3 months when we have an exposure. If we do the antigen test, we can be almost 100% certain after a month whether the patient is HIV positive or the patient is HIV negative.
Now, say for the person who's, you know, coming into, say, your clinic and is slightly worried over whether or not they have it, do they have to, like, specifically ask for this test, or are you going to be able to know from, say, the story that they're able to give what needs to be taken?
I do. I'd have to know. Now, just before I go on to that, I want to talk about two kind of, little kind of sciencey bits.
Okay.
When we're talking about tests, we talk about two things in particular. One's called the sensitivity of a test, and the other's called the specificity of a test.
Okay.
Now, it sounds kind of a bit over the top, but it's quite important.
Okay.
Because for the sensitivity of a test, it means that if a patient is HIV positive, the test is going to be positive.
Okay.
So what you want to do is have a low risk of false negatives. So you want to be sure that if the patient is positive, you're going to pick that patient up on the test. The other side of that then is the specificity of a test. And the specificity of a test means that if the patient doesn't have HIV, the test will be negative. So you don't want people to get false positives.
Okay.
So you want to be quite happy the patient has, you know, is diagnosed appropriately.
Okay.
Now, I mentioned the window period earlier on. The big problem with sensitivity of a test, if you pick up a patient and you do a test too soon, you're going to get a false negative. So you have a patient who could potentially be positive and you diagnose them as being negative on the basis of a test.
Gotcha.
Okay. At the moment, we have new kits called rapid HIV tests, or some people call them point of care tests. And the reason they're called point of care is I can see a patient in my surgery. I can do a finger prick, I can do a saliva test, and after 10 to 15 minutes, I can reliably tell that patient whether the test is reactive or not.
Wow.
Okay. Now, a reactive test doesn't almost automatically mean that it's a positive HIV test. Mm-hmm. I'd always want to confirm that in the laboratory, but you get a good handle on whether the patient is actually HIV positive or not.
And when you're saying a good handle now, like maybe in terms of percentages,
yeah, okay. For the particular test I use, there's a 99.5% sensitivity. That means in 1 in 200, you're going to get a false negative test.
Okay, but that is still fairly accurate.
It's very good. It's as good as the ones we send to the lab, by and large. But we have to be very, very mindful that if you do a test, you can't just, it's particularly in a high-risk group. Yeah. If a gay man comes into me and I take a full sexual history and I know the patient is high-risk and is tested negative, just like a blood test, you have to say to yourself, maybe I'm testing this patient too soon, maybe I'll have to bring that patient back.
Okay. So this is why in most cases, if people do get checked out, they will be asked to come back.
They'd certainly be recommended. Now, I mentioned a few minutes ago about the antigen test. Mm. The antigen test is a blood test that we have available in the laboratory. Up to last year, we didn't have that available in rapid HIV test kits. So we only had the antibody test, which brings it back to a window period of 3 months. You'd have to repeat the test 3 months after exposure.
Okay. Gotcha.
Now, in a low-risk group, if somebody comes into me and on the basis of a sexual history, say they haven't had sex in 6 months and the HIV test is negative, well, I know the window period is 3 months, so I know they're negative.
Okay.
I'd be quite confident. But if somebody comes in and is quite sexually active and the test is negative, but I would feel that they could be high-risk, I'd always bring them back.
Okay.
As well as that, I would always send a sample to the laboratory because the laboratory will do the antigen and the antibody test.
Okay,
just to be on the safe side.
Okay. So we've mentioned the likes of the rapid HIV testing kits that are available. Now, I've seen, at least online, I've noticed that they seem to be available in the UK, they seem to be available in the US. In an Irish context, how readily available are they?
Unfortunately, not in walk-in public clinics at the moment. They're not available, but they're not hugely expensive, so that I'm guessing that will change fairly soon. It's kind of a manpower because you want to have somebody who's going to be available to do the tests, and in our sexual health clinics at the moment, they are so busy. It's very, very difficult to free somebody else, to free a nurse, free a technician to actually do those testings. In private settings, yes, they are available, and for anybody who wants to, you can get the tests on the net.
Okay, you know, is that type of thing reliable? Because we have this idea, you know, if you're buying something on, say, obviously this is very flippant, but you know, on eBay or something like that, you know, that you might not be able to rely on these tests so much. If you buy something online like that, it is reliable.
I've never done it, but I'm guessing the test would be reliable. My worry is that if you have somebody who does a HIV test and it tests positive and they've no supports, they're sitting in a flat in a bedsit in Rathmines and they're on their own, and even it could be a true positive or a false positive, they now think they've got HIV and they've had no preparation, no professional preparation. Okay. I would obviously advocate that these tests be used because I think they're very, very good. Mm. But I do think it's very important for the doctors, nurses, whoever's doing them, to be mindful, number one, that you get false positives and false negatives, and number two, that you have to have the psychological supports in place for the patient in the event of a positive test.
Okay, yeah, that is very important indeed. For anyone who just wants to I guess, avail of these services, you said that in a private context, at least, they are a bit more available rather than a public setting.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier in terms of what exactly is done. Now, you were mentioning a window of 15 minutes and you'll know.
It takes about 15 minutes, and unfortunately it's a kind of a tight window, because if you leave a test for more than 20 minutes sitting on a desk, it'll turn positive. It'll look like it's positive.
Really?
So you have to be very careful not to spend too much time talking to the patient, then turn around and see the test.
That's fascinating positive. Though. So you have to be aware of the time when you're doing this.
Yeah, obviously each test comes with its own specifications and its own timings, but the kits I would use now, we say 10 minutes would be ideal, 20 minutes max, and over 20 minutes you could get a false positive.
That's really interesting. Okay, and obviously we'd probably get too technical if we start explaining why.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Plus, I don't know.
That's fair enough. But it is an interesting development in terms of HIV testing, and indeed, I guess it shows the history of the treatment as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm very, very mindful. Things have changed hugely since I just trained in HIV medicine back in, you know, I won't tell you how long ago. And I think it's the most important thing now is for somebody to know their HIV status. Mm. And I'm very much of the mind that people should be testing for HIV all of the time. Mm. Do an opportunistic testing. If you go to your GP with the pain in your big toe and you happen to be in a particular risk group for HIV, you should be offered a HIV test. I think it's much more sensible. The worst case scenario is people don't know their status, are around infecting other people, and again, if they don't have the HIV diagnosis picked up early enough, they could present with a very advanced disease, which can be quite difficult to treat, you know, 20 years down the line.
Well, in that case, that's no better reason, I would say, to make sure that you are tested regularly enough.
All right. Absolutely.
Shay, if anyone wants to find out more information, of course, they can go on to stdclinic.ie.
That's right.
All right. Basically. Well, in the meantime, Dr. Shay Keating, our resident sexual health expert here on the Cosmo and RT Pulse, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Online, on DAB, on Fairview, and on UPC, channel 943. This is RT Pulse.